there's only 5 of you in the meeting, sir.
Chairperson, sorry, we have 6 members on the platform.
Oh, yes, Mr. Duvillier, sorry. Yeah, I forgot. Yeah. Now that we do have a quorum.
Okay.
I forgot Mr. Victoria is the member.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, all.
Good morning, Victoria. You are welcome. Good morning, honorable members. The meeting is officially open. Let me welcome members of this committee. Welcome Treasury, National Treasury. I'm not sure.
We have an apology from Honorable Skosana.
Okay, this apology from Skosana is attending what do we call it?
Chair, just from your comments, we've also got the TLAB, the TALAB, the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill, but we also have the Rates and Monetary Thresholds Bill. And Chair, just to remind members, these are draft bills. They've not been tabled yet. In the text process, just to remind ourselves, we release these on the Treasury website and the SARS website, and then have the hearings because, except for one, all the bills are money bills, and there's the procedure that you have to deal with changes to money bills. And honourable members, just again to remind ourselves, I mean, with tax bills, the issue is really that we don't have prior consultations before the budget, and because tax proposals are sensitive, sort of market sensitive, they basically just announced by the Minister of Finance on budget day. So sometimes there's a bit of shock and awe, particularly when the minister announces a new tax or introduces a tax, and consultations only start after the announcement. And for that reason, it's quite possible that we have to make changes to the proposals that the ministers announce. And so if you look at the process, what tends to happen is after the minister announces, we need to do some technical consultations on some of the proposals because we've not been able to consult before. And that's what takes us between February and basically July, when the TLAB and TALAB bills are published, and in this case, the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. With the Rates Bill, that bill is published, a draft is published on budget day, because they only relate to the rate changes. We don't try and deal, normally don't try and deal with any other complex issues. So, Chair, we've got a big team. From the Treasury, you've got Yana Buta and Chris Axelson and their teams in the Treasury. And from SARS, I didn't see the commissioner, but the commissioner is here, and Franz Tomasek sort of lead their teams from SARS. But just to go through the process this year, Chair and Honourable Members, because, you know, there are some significant proposals, and the big one relates to the retirement, the two-pot system, which is a change that's been brought through the tax bills. And you can expect, I think, to have quite a lot of comments on those. And for that reason, we kept them in a separate bill, but Tianga can explain that in more detail. So what happened was, once once the minister announced on budget day, as I said, we published the rates bill. And if you look at the overview, it was first published on budget day. And then we published again on the 29th of July to solicit comments. But in between, what happened with the rates bill was that we saw that, I think it was just a day after the budget when Russia went into Ukraine, and it had an impact on oil prices and on many other prices. And we faced a lot of pressure when the fuel price shot up. So announcements were made on the fuel levy, which had led to changes in this bill. So normally, as I said, the rates bill contains, sorry, I don't know if the slides are on, Chris or Yanga, I don't know who's running the slides. So just to get to the first slide, the rates bill was published on budget day, and it contains the tax announcements made in the 2022 budget. So it deals with changes in rates and monetary thresholds and increases of the excise duties on alcohol and tobacco. It also contains changes tabled by the Minister in Parliament on 31st March 2022 and 31st May 2022 regarding temporary relief on fuel levy, as well as the postponement of the effective date of an increase in the health promotion levy, which we delayed by a year. So this bill, the draft rates and monetary amounts and amendment revenue laws bill, therefore, as I said, was published, every time there was a change, we published it, and we published it again on the 29th July, and contains the proposed amendments to the Income Tax Act with the two-point retirement system. The proposed amendments give, that's the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill that I'm talking about. So that was published on the 29th of July, and it contains a two-pot retirement system proposal. And these amendments all give effect in all these bills to the announcements made in February last year. And on the two pots, it was an announcement that was also made in November last year when we published and followed a discussion paper that we had published. So next slide, please. And then with regard to the TLAB bill, the Tax Laws Amendment Bill, which is a money bill, all the previous bills that I've mentioned, the revenue laws and the draft rates and monetary amounts bills are Section 75 bills in terms of the Constitution, or money bills, I should say. And similarly, the TLAB is a money bill, and that contains the remainder of the tax announcements that are made in Chapter 4 of the Budget Review, in the Minister's Speech, in Chapter 4 of the Budget Review, and what we call Annexure C in a Budget Review, which are all the technical improvements and changes that we've had to make. And following the budget, and following some of these issues, there were also technical consultations held with selected stakeholders just to help us prepare for the coming legislation. So we had to look at the impact of IFRS 17 contracts on the taxation of short-term and long-term insurers. We had to clarify the definition of contributed tax capital and clarifying the tax treatment of collateral arrangements. We'll speak through these, Chair. but we're just alerting you to the process itself that's taken place. And then, of course, we have the Talab Bill, which deals with all the administrative issues. And the Talab Bill itself, that's a Tax Administration Laws Amendment Bill, actually deals, is a Section 76 bill, because it's not a money bill. And in terms of the Constitution, we have to split the bills between the money bills and the non-money bills. So there's two separate types of bills that we have. And as I said, money bills are in terms of Section 77 of the Constitution, but they then get treated in terms of Section 75 in terms of process, but Section 77 adds further details to compel that only the Minister of Finance can introduce them in Parliament, and that they have to start in the National Assembly. The tax bills, and sorry, I've had my numbering wrong, and the non-money bill, which is the Talab Bill, is also dealt with in terms of Section 75, but it's an ordinary Section 75 bill. So there's no Section 76 in this process. So the draft bills, as we said, were all published on the 29th of July on the Treasury and SARS website. And we also take comments, which we bring to Parliament. But the primary place to comment is to Parliament. But just to give us some notice on some of the areas that come up. And as we know, then between SCOF and CCOF, in that sequence, you have public hearings on these draft bills. And Treasury then engages with many of these stakeholders, because this is the first time they actually have to actually look at the detail as it's going to be legislated. So in February, they've heard the announcement. And they still don't have all the details, the nitty-gritty of how the text will be implemented. That is only done when they see the July version, the 29th July version of the actual bills. So it's quite a tight process, Chair and Honourable Members, as you know, in terms of time. So we look forward to those comments. And then we obviously, under the committee, the bills get processed. We come with the response document and so on. Next slide, please. So that's just the process. I know it's been a mouthful, lots to talk about. Now we come to the specific bills themselves, and starting with the rates bill, which we, as we said, went through three rounds of changes, if I'm not mistaken, but Yanga can correct me. Yanga, are you going to come in, or Chris? I don't know who's going to do these slides.
I think I'm going to do these ones, Robert.
Okay, Chris, coming.
Thank you. Good morning, Honourable Members. This morning, Chair. So we presented to the committee on the draft rates bill, which included the changes to the personal income tax table, the changes to the excise duties on alcohol, changes to medical tax credits. So a lot of the rate changes that were announced in the budget in February, we presented that to the committee on the 22nd of March. Since then, as Momo was saying, there have been a couple of changes to the rates bill that we've since put in. So just to quickly run you through those, the first one was on the fuel levy. So the fuel price had increased quite dramatically, really. And we initially implemented a two-month reduction in the general fuel levy of R1.50 per litre. So that was from the 6th of April. And we were doing it for 2 months. So it reduced the levy by about 40%. It was going to cost us about $6 billion in lost revenue. The plan was to sell the strategic oil stocks to pay for that. And that is still the plan. And that is what is being done. And we also announced some other measures to try and limit the increases, in the fuel price. After a couple of months, on the 31st of May, the price was still going up. And we extended the temporary fuel levy relief for another 2 months, where we did R1.50 reduction in the fuel levy for one more month in June, and then we dropped the fuel levy relief to about 75 cents for the next month. And that ended at the end of August. That was going to cost about $4 billion in revenue for GON, and that's expected to be taken into account in the fiscal framework in the medium-term budget policy statement. So those 4 months of relief are then included in the revised draft rates bill. And at the moment, that relief has ceased, and luckily the prices are coming down and should come down again next month. The other measure that we have adjusted in the rates bill since we last presented to you is the implementation date of the health promotion levy. We had stated in the budget that the levy itself would be increased by 4.5% to 2.31 cents per gram. And we said that was going to start from 1 April 2022. We did also announce that we were going to start consultations on lowering the threshold for the health promotion levy. Currently, the threshold is 4 grams of sugar per 100 moles. So if you have a lower sugar content than that, you don't pay the tax. And if it's above, you only start paying the tax from 4 grams onwards or upwards. And also to extend the levy to 100% fruit juices. However, we did have consultations with the Minister of Agriculture, Land
Recording
Reform,
in progress.
And the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition. And after those consultations, we released the Minister of Finance released a media statement on 1 April 2022 to delay the implementation of that 4.5% increase for 1 year to 1 April 2023. So we are going to still have consultations on the threshold and potentially extending it to 100% fruit juices. And we will do that as soon as we've released the discussion paper, which should be out very shortly. Thanks, Mama.
No, thanks, Chris. So we now get to, as I said, quite a big area of interest, which is the draft laws amendment bill, which deals with the two-pot retirement system. I'm going to ask Alvina and Taylor and Basil Maseko to come in and walk through the slides and make some comments. Perhaps in between. But over to you, Alvina and Basil.
Thanks, Mama, and good morning, colleagues, Chairperson and honorable members. So I think as Mama mentioned earlier, So I think as all you might be aware, the South African government embarked on retirement reform since 2012.
Alvina, you must put your camera on as well whilst you speak.
Oh, sorry, I had put my camera on, but I didn't switch it on. Sorry about that. Okay, so as I was saying, guys, I think we might all be aware that South Africa embarked on the retirement reform process in 2012, even though actually dates way before that, likely to address gaps, addressing inadequate retirement provision for members. There has been some significant progress since 2012 on a number of reforms, and these include the harmonization of the tax treatment between different types of retirement funds, as well as the annuitization by Provident Fund members since 2012. You can move to the next slide, Chris. So the current policy and legislative proposal follows the announcement that was made by the minister and the subsequent release of the discussion paper in 2012. The main proposal here is to address the disharmony in preservation between the different retirement funds. The intention with the policy proposal as well as the legislative changes is to introduce a two-pot system. Maybe some might say three pots, but we call it a two-pot system. Those pots, it would be the savings pot, the retirement pot, as well as the vested pot. So the two-pot system retains the current tax regime of EET, exempt tax. We're also retaining the tax deduction as is with 27.5% of gross remuneration up to 350K per year. The proposal is to start with the two-part system from 1st of March 2023, or you can say to house the three different parts from 1 March 2023, with the vested part being everything that has been accumulated before the system kicks in, and the savings part plus the retirement part starting from scratch. So the savings part, the proposal is that there is no seeding that will be allowed in the savings part. It will start from scratch. A maximum amount of new contributions, for argument's sake, let's say the system starts from 1 March 2023, a maximum of one-third of a member's contributions would go into the savings pot. We will not allow excess contributions into the savings pot. And amounts contributed into the savings system in excess of the tax deduction will be moved to the retirement pot. The savings pot will allow withdrawals over a 12-month period. However, if a member does not withdraw in that 12-month period, that amount can be withdrawn in the following 12-month period. A minimum withdrawal amount is 2K. Withdrawals from the savings pot will be added to a member's taxable income in the year of the withdrawal and will be subject to tax in the hands of the individual, normal income tax rules applying. A member cannot transfer into the savings pot, but they can move money from the savings pot into the retirement pot. But new money in excess of what is allowed in the savings pot cannot go in. On the death of an individual member or at retirement, any amount that is available in the savings pot will be taxed in terms of the retirement lump sum tax table. And also when a member ceases to be a tax resident for an uninterrupted period of 3 years or leaves the country when their visa expires, that amount can be withdrawn subject to the member's normal tax income. I can move to the next slide. And the retirement pot, this is the pot that will be subject to full preservation when a member resigns or changes jobs. Not less than two-thirds of a member's contributions should go into the retirement pot. Contributions that are allocated to the savings pot, that are not allocated to the savings pot, can go into the retirement pot. As I've mentioned earlier, any excess contributions to the savings pot will fall or follow into the retirement pot. Because this is subject to full preservation, when a member resigns, they cannot access contributions that have gone into the retirement pot. At retirement, the retirement pot is subject to full annuitization, subject to the de minimis threshold, which is 167,500. So if whatever member has accumulated in the retirement pot is below this de minimis threshold, they can choose to withdraw. I've mentioned that savings or excess contributions can go into the retirement pot. Also, transfers can be made into the retirement pot, but transfers cannot be made out of the retirement pot. Similarly, when a member leaves the country and ceases to be a tax resident for an uninterrupted period of 3 years or their visa expires, they can withdraw what they've contributed into the retirement pot subject to the withdrawal tax table. So the vested pot is all contributions and growth that a member has accumulated prior to implementation date. So that retirement interest will be accorded a vested right, meaning that when a member resigns, they should be able to withdraw this vested pot if they choose to, or they can transfer it to another fund if they choose that option. So no contributions will be allowed into the vested pot. What a member has contributed before the two-pot system comes into effect will be ring-fenced as a vested pot, subject to current rules as we have them now. No contributions are made into that pot, but when a member resigns, they can withdraw that or transfer that. The difference will only apply to Provident Fund members who were 55 years and older on 1 March 2021. They had a vested right when the annuitization requirement came into effect. That vested right will continue with the two-pot system. Vested rights or the vested pot can be transferred from one vested pot to another fund's vested pot free of tax. Similarly, when a member ceases to be a tax resident for an uninterrupted period of 3 years or their visa expires, they can withdraw what is in the vested pot subject to the current tax system that applies, so that will apply prior to the implementation of the two-pot system. Also, when a member retires, the two-pot system will be treated in terms of the current rules or the rules that applied before the two-pot system came into effect, meaning that if you are in a pension fund, you have to annuitize two-thirds. If you are above what you've accumulated is above the de minimis. I think I've spoken to that last bullet, that rules of the fund applicable prior to the implementation of the two-pot system will continue to apply to the vested pot. Thanks, Momo. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, no, thanks, Chair. Let me just add a few points just on this two-pot system. I think what we'll also do is, as you would have seen in the media, there's a lot of focus on this, you know, and often for the wrong reason. The issue for us is how can we get more preservation? As it is, we as South Africans, we don't save much. And whilst we have a good system with those who are employed and getting salaries and covered by bargaining council arrangements, generally do contribute towards a work retirement fund, we find that they don't save because we have a gap in our system where when people resign from work, they then access all their savings. So by the time they retire, they have very little left. And there's one way to also make sure we build asset wealth of employees and those working and who have retirement funds. It's quite critical that we focus on preservation. But you know, we don't take a pure approach on preservation. In some countries, you can't withdraw at all. We accept that at some point in their life, work cycle, people go through specific difficulties or emergencies, and hence we've created the savings pot. We really don't want them to also start withdrawing from their savings point needlessly. They should try and preserve it as much as possible. So the approach we're taking is that because the whole retirement system is so linked to the tax system, where your contributions, for example, are deducted, you receive a tax deduction, that we've had to make the changes through the tax system in creating the different pots and making sure that on the one hand, people are preserving and we have certain incentives from the tax system to get people to continue to preserve. I should add, Chair, that once this basic architecture is finalized, we'll be through normal pension legislation, looking at how we can, improve the incentive structure to get people to save more and over longer periods. So, for example, we hope that for many funds, if the current contribution is 15%, that perhaps they'll take it to 16 or 17% towards the savings pot, so that people are encouraged to save more. And if you look at all the other pending retirement reforms, we've had quite a lot of reforms to harmonize the tax system between provident and pension funds. But what we want to do is, we've said, we want to get a system of mandatory contributions. So even if you work on contract, that you have to put aside a certain percentage towards a retirement fund in your name. And so those systems, I think, will also expand coverage. And those we hope to do early next year. So there's a few outstanding reforms. What we will do, Chair, is just make to members available some of the statements we've put out on these changes and some of the Q&As and so on that we have. And I do expect this area to get to receive lots of comments. We've had to make lots of judgment calls. This is not the only way to do it. And how you withdraw the whole issue of seed funding, all of that will come into focus, I think, when we have the hearings. But next slide, please. So just to close the loop, I think, on this. I think we'll just go on to T-Lab. I don't know who's coming in, Chris or Yanga.
Hi, Momo. Good morning, members. I will start with the draft T-Lab. The draft T-Lab has different sections. We are starting with individuals, employment, and savings. The first item there is reviewing the timing of accrual and incurral of variable remuneration. This proposal is assisting taxpayers. Currently, the Act makes special dispensation for variable remuneration and makes provision for the deferral of the taxation of variable remuneration to the date when the amount is received by the employee, as opposed to when it accrues to the employee. And this applies only to variable remuneration as defined in the tax legislation. And Section 7B defines variable remuneration to include overtime pay, bonuses or commission, allowances, an amount in which the employee is entitled to as a result of unutilized leave, and night shift and standby allowance. It came to our attention that even though commission is included in the definition of variable remuneration, however, the commission that is included there does not cater for informal sector commission, whereby such commission is calculated based on units produced. So that came to our attention. And in order to cater for the informal sector commission, because the current commission that is catered there is the formal sector commission, it is proposed that changes be made in the legislation to cater for the informal sector commission and change the definition of variable remuneration to include the kind of commission that is received by the informal sector. Thank you. The next slide. Apportionment of the tax interest exemption and capital gains tax annual exclusion when an individual ceases to be tax resident. In 2012, clarification was made in the Income Tax Act to provide that when an individual ceases to be South African tax resident, that individual's year of assessment is deemed to have ended on the date immediately before the day the individual ceased to be tax residency. And that clarification was made because there was a court case, trade hold court case. So after that court case, we were forced to make that clarification in the legislation. This section further provides that the individual's next succeeding year of assessment is deemed to commence on the day on which tax residency is ceased. Now, it came to our attention that the above deeming provision results in the individual having 2 years of assessment during any 12-month period. And that makes it possible for the individuals to double up on certain exemptions or exclusions that are allowable their year of assessment. And this is against the policy rationale. For example, these exemptions like your interest exemption and your capital gains tax exclusion. So in order to address this anomaly, we are making changes to Section 10 of the Income Tax Act dealing with exemption, the interest exemption, as well as paragraph 5 of the schedule dealing with the capital gains tax exclusion, so as to apportion the interest exemption and the capital gains tax exclusion to cater for a situation whereby the individual can have 2 years of assessment in 1 year. Thank you. Now, we will be dealing with the retirement, and I'm handing over to Nomvula, who's our specialist in this.
Good morning, everybody. The first retirement-related issue deals with the transfer of total interest in a retirement fund. So as the legislation currently stands, members of retirement funds are allowed to transfer their retirement interest from one retirement fund to another. These transfers are, however, subject to certain conditions, namely that the transfer be from either a similar fund to another similar fund or from a less restrictive to a more restrictive fund. And instances where the individual is a member of a retirement annuity fund, such transfers need to be a transfer of the total interest in the transferor fund. Now, as relates to retirement annuity fund members, the fact that they are required to transfer their total interest limits their flexibility in instances where an individual has more than one contract within a specific retirement annuity fund. Now, to afford members of retirement annuity funds a certain degree of flexibility, what is being proposed in this year's legislation is that individuals be allowed to effect transfers of on a per contract basis. However, such transfers will, however, be required to meet certain conditions as a means of ensuring that the current RA de minimis is not contravened. Next slide, please. Okay, as Alvina mentioned when discussing the two-part system, there were a number of retirement reforms that were effected from 2013. One of these is the annuitization requirements for Provident and Provident Preservation Fund members, which came into effect on the 1st of March, 2021. Now, as part of these reforms, a distinction was made between historic and new vested rights, historic being vested rights that accrued prior to 1 March 2021, and new vested rights being those that accrued with effect from 1 March 2021. Now, subject to meeting certain conditions, historic and new vested rights will remain protected. It has, however, come to our attention that as the legislation currently stands, in the event that an amount is transferred into a public sector fund, historic vested rights, the protection, sorry, of historic vested rights will be forfeited. This, however, goes against the policy intent. So what this proposal intends to do is to clarify that historic vested rights will remain protected irrespective of which fund it is being transferred from or into. Next slide, please. Okay. Now, the following amendment follows from consequential changes that were made following the coming into effect of the annuitization provisions. Now, as the policy intent currently stands, any annuities received from a retirement fund, irrespective of the type of fund that they are received from, are to be included in the individual's gross income. But as the legislation currently stands, public sector pension funds, which operate in the same manner as provident funds, are not covered in the current provisions of the legislation. This despite the intention being that they also be included. So what this amendment proposes to do is to clarify that irrespective of the fact that the pension fund operates as a provident fund, any annuities received from said fund should be included in gross income. So basically the intention of this amendment is to ensure parity across all the various retirement funds and to ensure that legislation and practice speak to the same thing. Next slide, please. Okay. So another intention, if I can put it that way, of the retirement reforms that came into effect in March 2021 was to ensure parity in the tax treatment across the various retirement funds. So what happens now is because of the existence of paragraph 4.3 in the second schedule of the Income Tax Act, there is differentiated treatment between pension and provident funds, specifically in instances where a member of a provident fund retires from that fund on grounds other than ill health. So what happens is that in the provident fund definitions, the lump sum received will be subject to a more preferential tax rate, which does not apply to members of pension funds. So what the intention of the amendment of proposed amendment to the legislation is to ensure that irrespective of whether the member is retiring from a pension or provident fund, that the tax treatment of the withdrawal benefit received from said fund is taxed in the same manner. Next slide, please. Okay. Now, as previously mentioned, the Act makes provision for individuals to transfer from one retirement fund to the other. And in instances where these transfers are permissible, the legislation allows for the transfers to happen on a tax neutral basis. Now, prior to the retirement coming into effect of the annuitization provisions in March 2021, irrespective of when the amount was contributed in the respective fund, provided that the transfer was permissible, the full amount transferred would benefit from the tax-free transfer concessions that are available. Now, what happened is, as the legislation currently stands and following an oversight in some of the consequential amendments that were made following the coming into effect of the annuitization provisions, as the law currently stands, if an amount is transferred and the portion of the amount being transferred relates to amounts contributed prior to 1 March 2021, the portion of the retirement interest that relates to pre-1 March 2021 contributions that is being transferred will unfortunately not enjoy tax neutral transfer status. Now, to correct this oversight and ensure alignment with policy intent, it is being proposed that the legislation is amended to clarify that irrespective of when the contributions were made, in the event that the transfer is permissible, the full amount transferred will enjoy tax neutral status.
Okay, thank you, Chair. That is the end of the first part, which is individuals and savings. The next part of the draft TLAB is general business taxes. Next slide. The first proposed amendment is clarifying the definition of contributed tax capital. I wish to state that this is one of the contentious proposed amendments, which dates back from the 2021 tax amendments. And as indicated in the earlier slide, slide four, that after the budget announcement, we did have technical consultation with the affected stakeholders to discuss the technical proposed amendment. This proposal, we did have technical consultation with the affected stakeholders to discuss this proposal because it was historically coming from the 2021 tax amendment. So this comes from the 2021 budget review, whereby we made an announcement to make changes to the definition of contributed tax capital so as to limit the possible exploitation of these provisions. As such, amendments were proposed in the 2021 draft TLAB. And the initial proposed effective date of the amendment was 1 January 2022. After reviewing the public comments received on the draft TLAB, and after the stakeholders have made parliamentary representation during public hearings, the effective date of the amendment was changed to 1 January 2023. And then we mentioned in the budget that National Treasury will want to have more time to review the impact of the proposal, and the possible amendments could be made in the 2022 legislative cycle. So we did have meetings around May with the affected stakeholders in preparation for this. As such, after the meetings in the 2022 draft TLAB, it is proposed that changes be made now to the proviso of the definition of contributed tax capital to allow for targeted transactions. So now what we are doing is that instead of making a provision, an anti-avoidance measure, which is more general, we have a targeted anti-avoidance measure. Another proposal is to make changes to include another anti-avoidance measure that will require a company to test whether the contributed tax capital had equally been allocated to all shareholders of the class of shares proportionally to their shareholding for a running 91-day period before and after each and every transfer. As a consequence, should any previous or any future distribution within the 91-day period before and after distribution not have been allocated contributed tax capital within the class of shares, none of those transfers made during that period will be able to be allocated the contributed tax capital. I wish to stress that this proposal was made after the consultation with the affected stakeholders. I know that because during the consultation process, they would want sometimes to channel the wording or to channel the proposal in one way or the other. But we as government decided to make the proposal in this manner. But we know that maybe during public hearings, they will come with different proposal. Officially, the parliament as the legislature will decide in terms of this proposal. Next slide. This one deals with refining the reversal of the nil-based cost rules applicable to intra-group transactions. Currently, South Africa, we don't have group taxation rules. However, we have sections dealing with intra-group transfers, whereby there is deferral of tax. This follows an amendment that was made in 2021, whereby in 2021, we made amendments to intra-group transaction rules in the corporate reorganization provisions to clarify the application of the reversal of the nil-based cost rules in instances that a group company acquires an asset in terms of a deferred tax intra-group transaction. And within 18 months, the acquirer of an asset disposes of that asset
and it triggers the tax deferral benefit in respect of that asset disposed of. As previously indicated, South Africa does not have group taxation rules. So in these corporate reorganization rules, we normally have anti-avoidance measures which are aimed to limit the exploitation of these provisions. I will hand over to Lerato Ralegwa, who is the specialist in this regard. Over to you, Lerato.
Sorry about that. I had muted myself. Okay. Are we going to the next slide? Or the very same one?
Very same one, Lerato.
Okay. So I think just to recap, there has been ongoing changes to the nil-based cost rules. Because essentially what the nil-based cost rule seeks to do is lock in a person who has benefited from the Section 45 deferral rules into the rules by removing the tax attributes from, say, the assets being the preferences or the debt that they've used to acquire an asset. By doing that, basically, we're saying that you are going to have to retain that debt or the preference shares, because if you get rid of it, you don't have base cost. It's going to be costly to get rid of it. So there are two instances that we have noted where the nil base cost is still needed, right? Within the reorganization rules, there are other anti-avoidance rules and the interplay of them needed to be corrected. So, for example, when an asset is disposed beyond 18 months, because that's another lock-in period rule, we no longer need to lock you in within the rules because we don't suspect that you're abusing the rules. So in that instance, when you dispose of an asset that basically the tax consequences were deferred to beyond 18 months, you no longer need to have a nil base cost. We are trying to reinstate that base cost. Another amendment that we're making is actually a follow-up from last year's one. It's quite small. It's actually a correction of the amendment done last year, was that when you cease to form part of the same group of companies, there's a clawback penalty. So that's also another lock-in type mechanism that we use to make sure that the 45 rules are not abused. So what we did last year, that when you cease to form part of the same group of companies, you've got your base cost again. So we reversed the no base cost rule. If you had suffered that penalty, if you cease to be a part of the same group of companies, then you were the transfer and the transferee. Now we're adding the relationship of transferor and controlling, so transferee and controlling company in relation of transferor. So basically here it's just a shareholder that's been put into the mix, because that also can trigger a degrouping provision. I think we can go to the next slide. The debt forgiveness rules. Okay, this is also not a huge one, but it is sort of trying to tighten up the rules that we have in the debt forgiveness rules. Sorry, I've been told to switch on my video. Okay. All right. So this one is about the debt forgiveness rules. Under the debt forgiveness rules, we have a set of rules that are aimed at essentially laying out the tax treatment of debt forgivenesses. So when you owe somebody a debt between companies, when one company owes another entity a debt and they've used it for, you know, the operating expenses to acquire an asset and so forth, these rules come into play when that debt is then waived or written off, or what we then label as forgiven. So under the rules, we have a recoupment that is triggered, right? When the debt is forgiven, subsequent to you having been advanced that debt and used it to acquire an asset, say, for example, right? So the way it is written, it doesn't cover all the instances in the subsequent transaction, say, of the forgiveness where we could have a recoupment. It refers to, it currently refers to an instance where you have to look at adding a recoupment or basically including an amount of the recoupment in your income where you'll be taxed on it in the instance where subsequent to you being advanced a debt, and under that debt you may have gotten interest deductions and so forth, you then dispose of the asset and there's a bit of a recoupment. So the amount over and above, say, in the debt forgiveness rules, which is in excess to the recoupment that would have been there in respect of the asset, is then also added into your income. However, there are instances where you sell an asset and you don't get a recoupment. You actually recognize a loss. So in your, you may have a scrapping allowance or a capital loss. That instance is not covered. And it's intended that it should be covered then. In your debt forgiveness, so when the debt is forgiven and you've disposed of the asset in the previous year of assessment and you had a loss, that forgiven debt, you also need to look at whether there's an element of recoupment in it, and then you also include it in your income. So this is, in essence, tidying up of our debt forgiveness rules in respect of recoupment. The next slide, please. Okay, this one is interesting, especially in the times we're in post COVID. We have a set of rules which have been there for quite some time now, the debtors allowance provisions in section 24. Under those provisions, where a taxpayer, right, sells goods or products to the public, on say on credit or so, and or well, not essentially credit, but where there's installments that you need to pay in respect of that those goods, and you only get the goods after the period of payment, and you've basically fully covered those payments. Under this provision, what happens is we move forward the inclusion of the receipt in respect of those goods that you sold, say over a period of time, say over 12 months, to the day that you enter into that arrangement, right? And in turn, there is an element of a debtor's allowance which says that you will get as a deduction against that brought forward income so much of the amount that you basically have not received at your end, right, in respect of an arrangement of at least 12 months. So where you enter into an arrangement with somebody will then pay you installments over a 12-month period for goods. You, as, say, the retailer, usually retailers, you have to recognize the full amount that you will receive under that arrangement on day one. And at year end, you then get this debtor's allowance, which is so much of the money that you haven't received. So it actually sort of aims to correct itself, that you will then be taxed on a cash basis. And then in the next year of assessment, that deduction is reversed, and then you do it again. Now, there's an issue around lay-by arrangements. Lay-by arrangements, by their nature, are shorter term arrangements. Right, your 3 months is sometimes can be as long as say 6 months, and it was never seen as a big problem that they do not get the benefit of a debtor's allowance, so they do not meet the requirement that this must be an arrangement of at least 12 months for you to get this debtor's allowance at the end of the year to cushion you. So, because they were just so short. But however, given the current economic climate coming from COVID, there'd been higher volumes of lay-by arrangements being entered into. And essentially, consumers are using them more and more. And even when you do your online shopping, you have that option when you pay. I don't know if you've both seen it, where you pay and you can actually do a 3-interval payment or 4-interval payment over there. So you're starting to see these a lot more. So because of now the higher volumes that we're seeing, a retailer and the tax advisor submitted these proposals that, I mean, essentially we should have some sort of cushioning for these type of arrangements, in that they also suffer the upfront inclusion, but they have no cushioning of a deduction. But I must say that I think they and engagements going forward. I don't know if that's it for now.
Thank you, Lerato. That's it for now.
Okay.
Okay. The next one is financial institution and products. Go to the next slide. This is one of the technical and biggest proposals in the 2022 budget review. The impact of IFRS 17 contracts on long-term insurers. We were notified that IFRS 17, the International Financial Reporting Standards are changing, and from IFRS 4 to IFRS 17. So the change in these financial reporting standards will have an impact in the manner, more especially the insurers are reporting their taxable income. So in order to minimize this impact, we had to make some transitional measures in the legislation. I want to put it up front that this is also one of the proposals whereby immediately after the budget, we've had technical discussions with the affected stakeholders. And the reason why we have included only insurers in that, historically, when there is the change in the reporting standards, it only affects mostly insurers. So we have seen that after we have released the draft bill for public comment, some taxpayers are already complaining to say that they want these transitional measures to apply to them as well. So I think when they come to Parliament for public hearings, there will be some of the comments, because they're going to say that we are making these transitional measures only to be applicable to insurers, whereas maybe the IFRS standard is applicable to all. But our rationale was that historically, we normally make transitional measures only to the insurers, as they are the ones that are affected mostly. So after the budget, we had meetings with both the short-term and long-term insurers. During the public consultation, we were told that in terms of the short-term, the impact will be minimal, in some instances, zero. However, on the long-term insurers, the impact may be sizable, but it depends on insurers. As such, we made changes to the legislation, and our proposed changes are blanket because we're not going to choose. So we did take their comments, and we went back, whereby we have to make the changes that are broader and applying equally to everyone. So in order to limit the impact, these are the changes that we are proposing. First of all, this is the easy one, whereby we'll align the definitions and terminology of IFRS 4 to IFRS 17. And then the big one is the introduction of the transitional tax measures, so as to limit the impact of the phasing in. Next slide. As indicated, based on the discussions, the impact felt by the short-term insurers is minimal to nil, whereas the impact felt by the long-term insurers is sizable. As such, the proposed changes in terms of the phasing in period will differ based on the impact. With regard to the short-term insurers, we are proposing this, a phasing in period of 3 years,
whereas with the long-term insurers is the phasing-in period of 6 years. And then what will be phased in during this phasing-in period? We have what is called the phasing-in amount. In terms of the short-term insurers, it will be the difference between the amount that is deductible from income of a short-term insurer in terms of the current provisions of Section 28(3) and 28(3)(a) of the Act at the end of the year of assessment, commencing on or after 1 January 2022, but before 1 January 2023, determined under the current rules of the Act, and the amount of deduction for the measuring year had IFRS 17 been applied at the end of the measuring year. It is important to note that these two, the phasing in period and the phasing in amount, will be the contentious one during the public hearings, because this is where the gist is. With regard to long-term insurers, the phasing in period in this regard is 6 years, and the phasing in amount will be the difference between the adjusted IFRS amount determined under the current rules with reference to IFRS 4 at the end of the year of assessment commencing on or after 1 January 2022, but before 1 January 2023, and the adjusted IFRS value amount had IFRS 17 and the definition of adjusted IFRS value as amended by the 2022 TLAP been applied at the end of the year of assessment. Thank you. The next one is international tax. Next slide. Clarifying the deeming provision in respect of royalties derived by CFC. The Income Tax Act contains controlled foreign company corporation rules, controlled foreign company rules, whereby they are anti-avoidance rules that are aiming to tax the income of South African residents who are holding more than 50% of the shareholding in a foreign company. And the income is taxed as when it is earned. And the calculation of the income of that foreign subsidiary is calculated as if the income is a South African company. The most important rule contained in the CFC provision is that the net income of the CFC must be calculated as if the CFC is a taxpayer for South African tax purposes, and in some instances, as if the CFC is a resident when applying certain provisions of the Act. For example, a CFC is deemed to be a resident in relation to interest derived from a South African source. However, the CFC provision does not mention how the royalties derived by the CFC should be treated. So this is an oversight. In order to correct this oversight, it is proposed that the deeming provisions for Section 92A be extended to cater for royalties. Next slide. Clarifying the treatment of amounts from hybrid equity instruments deemed to be income under CFC rules. The CFC rules contain an exclusion applicable to a payer and payee for intra-group interest, royalties, rental income, insurance premium, or income of similar provision nature, provided both payer and payee are part of the same group of companies. One important aspect of the CFC legislation is that there is what is called tainted income, which is more of passive income. And the reason why the passive income is taxed is that in terms of the international tax principles, we see no reason why you have to go and establish a foreign subsidiary, whereas you'll be investing in passive income. And the rationale for that is that you could be investing in passive income even if you are here in South Africa. So the passive income of the CFC is regarded as tainted income and taxed immediately. However, there is an exclusion if the income is paid, but both the payer and the payee are part of the same group of companies, which is a similar exclusion as what Lerato was saying, whereby we afford a deferral of tax or an exclusion in terms of corporate reorganization if both companies form part of the same group of companies. In terms of hybrid equity instrument rules, certain dividends in relation to the recipient are deemed to be income. To ensure tax neutrality in this regard, it is proposed that specific reference be made to the exclusion of the payee companies deemed income for hybrid equity instruments between the CFCs. So this is more of a technical correction, but we have already received comments in this regard because we thought that this is a small change, but we will deal with the comments during the response document. The next slide. Draft TLAB tax incentives. I will hand over to Haley because the two proposals dealing with the access loss restriction and Section 23M interaction with mining companies, they flow from the corporate rate reduction from 28% to 27%. So they are part of the broad-based measures. Over to you, Haley. Thank you.
Thanks, Yanga. All right, so as Yanga mentioned, these were almost sort of consequential amendments. So we had an assessed loss restriction rule that had a sort of weird interaction with our current mining legislation. So we proposed to restrict the use of assessed losses carried forward as part of the corporate income tax package. And as you'll remember, this was to broaden the tax base and reduce the corporate income tax rate. And because of this anomaly, we're just trying to clarify how this should interact with the mining legislation. If you can go to the next slide, Chris. Thanks. All right. And then we also had a similar difficulty with respect to the interest limitation rules that we were strengthening. So you'll recall that we were strengthening these rules in respect of debts owed to people, persons that are not subject to tax as part of the corporate income tax package. And this was also part of broadening the corporate tax base, which enabled the lowering of the rate. And again, here we discovered an anomaly with how these rules interact with respect to mining operations. And so we're basically proposing to clarify how these rules should interact with one another. Thanks very much.
The next one, over to you, Lera.
Okay, thanks, Yanga. Okay. So the last one under the incentives is the tax treatment of an asset acquired as a government.
Can you put on your camera? Just to all those presenting, if they can, just put on your camera if you can.
I've actually really pressed this because Yanga even told me I had every intention of putting it on, but I don't seem to be coming on. Lila, can you come see what's happening here?
That's fine. Carry on.
Okay. So one that just hovers about. I'll keep talking. So essentially, we have a regime that caters for government grants. So all government grants are governed by these provisions under 12P, and it works along with the 11th schedule. So under the regime, you basically have the exemption of government grants. As a taxpayer, if you receive a government grant, that amount is exempt from tax. However, what happens within the regime is that when you have received an amount and then you use that amount to, say, acquire an asset or fund your operations and so forth, you no longer have tax attributes. So you don't have, your cost is not recognized because you're not incurring the cost. The government is actually incurring the cost for you. So you will not get access to the normal deductions that you get under the tax regime. The problem comes in with government grants in kind. So in the instance where, okay, somebody's sending me a message. Okay. And what happens then with government grants in kind is that you then have an instance where there's a slight difference in the tax treatment, which results in an anomaly that when you receive the actual asset and not the funding to acquire the asset, the current provisions don't talk to you no longer having those tax attributes, especially when dealing 11E, the wear and tear regime, because under the wear and tear regime, they don't look at cost, which you wouldn't have because you didn't incur the cost to acquire the asset. You just acquired the asset as a government grant. Under Section 11E, they look at the value of the asset. And when you receive the asset, it's a valuable item. So it has value. And then you get access to the wear and tear allowances, which has a double dipping effect on the fiscus, because you receive an asset for free from government. And then you also get access to deduction under the wear and tear allowances. So this amendment seeks to make the correction under 11E that if you receive a government grant, you do not get access to the wear and tear allowances in respect of that asset that you received as a government grant. Thank you.
Okay. The next item on the agenda is that Anissa will join us as and when she's available, because she's at the doctor's room. So I don't want to put pressure on her, but this is her speciality. Prepared this part of the presentation. Rulings that were made on VAT before 21 July 2019. So over the past 2 years, we have said that we will be looking at which rulings can we turn them into the law, and we put them into the law. This implies that some of the rulings will be done away with and may not be turned into law, but some of the rulings may be turned into law. So in the over the past 2 years, we've made some of the changes, and also in the 2022 draft TLAB, we are proposing to make some of the changes in the legislation to change some of the rulings into law. Next slide. The first one is reviewing the Section 72 decisions dealing with cross-border leases of foreign-owned ships and aircraft. In 2020, we made changes to the VAT Act to the definition of enterprise in instances where the lessee imports the following goods, namely ships, aircraft, and rolling stocks for use in South Africa. So what happened is that we said that when the lesser leases these, and they are foreign owned, they're not going to be regarded as if the lessee is carrying on an enterprise in South Africa. So it has come to government's attention that the new provision that has been made does not extend to apply in instances where the foreign lessor enters into a separate agreement with the South African resident lessee for purpose of leasing any foreign owned parts. What was brought to our attention was aircraft engines, because they said that with aircraft, you can list the engine of the aircraft. So in the 2022 draft TLAB, of an aircraft or a ship or a rolling stock and some of other parts, then that will not be regarded as carrying on an enterprise in South Africa. Next slide. Next slide, yes. The second one is reviewing the Section 72 decisions regarding with the VAT treatment of flash title sales. One of the decisions made in terms of Section 72 was the one dealing with the VAT treatment of flash title sales. A flash title is defined in the export regulation as a supply of movable goods by a vendor to a non-resident qualifying purchaser, which is QP1 in terms of the export regulation. Of which QP1 will subsequently supply those goods to QP2 for export. So the issue is the goods, even though they are received in South Africa, but they are not meant to be used or consumed in South Africa. As such, a ruling was issued to say that with regard to flash title sales, the acquirer of the right in sub decision will no longer be valid after 31 December 2021. We are proposing to make changes in the legislation so as to change that ruling into the law. Next slide. Next slide. Yes. Regarding documentary proof, slide 44. Sorry about that. Yes. So this one deals with the evidence for repossessed goods. So when goods are under installment credits, that are under installment credits are repossessed, the VAT Act deems the repossession to be supplied from the borrower to the debtor to the lender in order to permit the lender, who is the registered vendor, to recoup some of the output tax paid at the outset of the installment credit sale. So for example, if the car is repossessed, then it will go back to the lender. So the supporting documentation for this input tax adjustment is the invoice of VAT declaration, which is signed by the debtor. So it has been brought to our attention that by that time, if the goods are repossessed, it will be difficult for the lender to get the debtor to sign that VAT declaration because the relationship between the lender and the debtor is no more. So as a result, the commissioner before 21 July 2019 issued a ruling to say that the signature is not required in these instances. So because the ruling will expire on 31 December 2021, we are making changes to the law to say that in instances where the goods are repossessed, the declaration need not be signed by the debtor, but we are inserting other special conditions to that effect. Next slide. The VAT treatment of registration of certain foreign suppliers. The VAT Act, everything in the VAT Act falls under the definition of enterprise in Section 1. So the definition of enterprise in the VAT Act, read together with the provisions of Section 23, make provision for every person who's conducting an enterprise and whose taxable income has exceeded the registration threshold to register in South Africa as VAT. This applies even if such vendor does not have physical presence in South Africa. And now at issue is the administrative compliance challenges encountered by foreign entities with no physical presence in South Africa because they'll be required to register for VAT. So what we have said is that if that foreign entity is part of the group of companies in South Africa, we will make the registered vendor in South Africa a representative vendor and register on behalf of that foreign supplier. And that registered vendor who is in South Africa will be required to submit the tax returns on behalf of the foreign supplier. This is ease of administrative burden. So we've issued that ruling in that regard. So in view of the fact that the ruling will come to an end, we are proposing to introduce new provision to deal only with those foreign entities that form part of the same group of companies in South Africa. So provided that you are in the part of the same group of companies and another company is registered in South Africa, then you will get the special dispensation because you will be having a representative vendor who will be able to submit the tax returns to SARS. Next slide. The last one on the VAT is the pooling arrangement. Currently, the VAT Act makes provision for the pooling arrangements. And those pooling arrangements are the one contemplated in the Marketing of Agricultural Products Act and the one contemplated in the time sharing or sectional title. So it came to our attention that even though those pooling are contemplated in those various pieces of legislation, however, the Health Professional Council of South Africa, there are regulations that require medical doctors to enter into pooling arrangements based on the manner in which the Health Professional Council regulates the practice of medical practitioners in South Africa. As such, before 2019, SARS issued a ruling in respect of the pooling arrangements that are created due to the policies of health professional council in South Africa. So in view of the fact that the ruling will come to an end on 31 December 2021, what we are proposing in the 2022 draft TLAB is that any pooling arrangements that are necessitated due to the regulation by any professional body in South Africa will fall under these provisions. So this is the end of the fact. Now we are going to carbon tax. Over to you, Charlene. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks, Yanga, very much for that. So broadly, the carbon tax proposals that have been included in Budget 22 is framed in the context of the outcomes from COP26 last year under the Paris Agreement and the requirements for countries to accelerate efforts to reduce emissions, in particular in the energy sector, as well as under the COP negotiations for South Africa submitted its commitments to reduce emissions. So we had put forward our second and third NDC, nationally determined contribution commitments, at the COP meeting last year. This is for the period 2020 to 2025 and then 2026 to 2030. The approach that has been taken for us to reduce our emissions is for emissions to peak in 2025 and then to decline from 2026 onwards. And we expect emissions to decline in the range of around 350 to 420 megatons in 2026. As part of our NDC, the carbon tax is one of the key policy measures that has been put forward. It forms part of the measures, including a system of carbon budgeting, as well as sector emission targets to be implemented by the Department of Environment. Next slide, Chris. This slide just gives an overview of the broader climate policy context in which we are operating in 2022 to help achieve the NDC commitments that we've set out. We're in the process of enacting the Climate Change Bill, which has been published for consultation, and there have been hearings on this bill. As part of the Climate Bill, the Department of Environment provides for sector targets, carbon budgets to companies, as well as a requirement for companies to develop mitigation plans and set out how they plan to reduce their emissions over the NDC period and beyond. We have also made a commitment or an aspirational commitment to net zero emissions by 2050, and this is also aligned with many other countries globally. Several companies have also made commitments to net zero emissions by 2050. There's a few mentioned around energy efficiency, green transport. There's a package of measures around tax incentives that are already in place. And to support a just transition, there are initiatives underway through the Just Energy Transition Partnership work to access climate finance, as well as the green finance taxonomy that was published by the National Treasury to promote a transitioning of the financial sector and reduce the risk of stranded assets. So this is the broader climate policy context within which the carbon tax is framed. Next slide, Chris. You can move on. So the carbon tax was introduced in June 2019 after an extensive consultation process. Just to reiterate, the tax seeks to give effect to the polluter pays principle. It aims to internalize the negative externality costs of climate change that are imposed on society and create those incentives for behavior change by firms, consumers across the board towards low carbon, more energy efficient and cleaner technologies. It forms part of the measures to help with our NDC commitments. And in the introduction of the carbon tax, a phased approach was taken to introducing this tax. So instead of starting off at a very high carbon tax rate that fully internalizes the externality costs of climate change, the tax was introduced at a relatively low rate to provide the signal for behavior change with significant tax free allowances ranging from around 60 to 95% of total greenhouse gas emissions of a particular company. And the intention behind this approach was to provide the space for industry to trans taxes going forward. Next slide. So the proposals announced in budget were essentially, firstly, to take into account the COVID pandemic and the slow growth of the country, to extend the first phase revenue recycling measures, which is the energy efficiency tax incentive and the commitment to electricity price neutrality, by 3 years to December 2025 to assist companies' transition. Beyond this transition period from 2026 onwards, and for the sets which are more ambitious from 2026 to 2030, the proposals include ramping up the carbon tax rate over the period 2026 to 2030 and over the longer term, and to strengthen the price signals. This approach was taken to provide policy certainty and to guide them in decisions that's required. Next slide. So as mentioned, for the period 2023 to 2025, the commitment to electricity price neutrality has been extended. So under this commitment, electricity generators as taxpayers can basically offset the payment of their electricity generation levy against their carbon tax liability, and they can also offset any additional purchases of renewable electricity, the costs of this against their tax liability up to December 2025. The energy efficiency savings tax incentive was introduced in, I think it was November 2013, and it was extended at the time of introducing the carbon tax in 2019 for a 3-year period to align with the first phase of the carbon tax, which was supposed to end in December this year. So to further assist companies with the transition, this tax incentive has been increased for a further 3 years until December 2025. We also have in place a carbon budget allowance of 5% that companies can claim under the carbon tax. This was put in place to encourage companies to participate in the voluntary carbon budgeting system of the Department of Environment. This voluntary carbon budget system will come to an end at the end of this year, and the mandatory carbon budgeting system is expected to come into effect from the 1st of January next year. So the carbon budget allowance of 5% will fall away as this mandatory carbon budgeting system comes into effect. We had also announced the penalty for non-compliance with the mandatory carbon budgets. It has not been included in the tax laws amendment bill at this stage. And the main reason for that is because the amendments can only be made to the Carbon Tax Act once the climate change bill is enacted. Next slide, please. So for the period 2023 to 2030, and to provide that policy certainty to companies around how the carbon tax rate would change over time and be strengthened, we had proposed in budget for an increase in the carbon tax rate by a minimum of $1 for the period 2023 to 2025, and then increasing to a $20 equivalent, rand equivalent in 2026, and $30 rand equivalent in 2030. The proposed amendments in the TLAB seek to give effect to these proposals and a progressive a carbon tax rate trajectory. So for the period 2023 to 2025, it is proposed that the rate adjustment is by $1 in 2023, $2 increase in 2024 from the 2023 rate, and a $3 increase in 2025 from the 2024 tax rate. For the period 2026 to 2030, the amendments proposed give effect to the $20 rand equivalent rate in 2026 and the $30 rate in 2030. And then for the period 2027 to 2029, there's a linear increase in the rate of $2.5 per year is proposed. And as mentioned, this aims to provide the longer-term policy and investor certainty and help to achieve the NDC commitments. Next slide, Chris. This is the last slide. So overall, the proposals for the carbon tax provide for an extension of the first phase revenue recycling measures and extends the transition period to companies to take early action to reduce their emissions and transition to more energy efficient and greener technologies and practices. It takes into account global policy developments through the European Union Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism that comes into effect next year, but with the actual financial adjustment being made to emissions intensive exports to the EU from 2026. It also takes into account proposals under the G20 and the IMF for minimal global carbon pricing. So going forward, higher carbon prices are unavoidable and earlier action to mitigate emissions would be required. This also presents a significant opportunity for an increase of new industries, meaningful jobs and technology innovation, in order to promote the competitiveness of our economy. And lastly, action is encouraged and companies are encouraged to take action to reduce emissions now or face these higher taxes in future. And also this will take into account broader developments around the climate change bill and implementation of the various additional policy measures that are being proposed. Thanks.
The next one is waiting. Over to you, Mpho.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, honorable members. With regards to vaping, government has signaled an intention to tax electronic nicotine and nicotine delivery system, and that was done in budget 2019 and subsequently in budget 2020. And this is was done at the backdrop of the growing presence of this new generation product in the market, and then also that the WHO has urged government to use the tobacco product control regulations at the national level to also cover this new generation product. So since then, National Treasury published a discussion document last year, where we had proposed that we apply a specific excise tax based on two components, based on the volume of the e-liquid and also the nicotine concentration on those solutions. But after we have received comments on the discussion paper, we made a revised proposal in the 2022 budget, where we then revised the proposal to a flat excise duty of 290 per tin content of the one was for January 2023. And the reason we had changed the proposal to a flat rate was that the issues around administration of determining the nicotine content of this product was going to impose quite a significant challenge on the administration of the tax. That's why therefore we made a revision to apply a flat rate regardless of the content of the solution. And after the consultation with January 2023, and the changes to the schedules I included there in the part that relates to the customs and excise. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now we go to the Administration Act. Over to you, Franz.
So, thank you, Yanga. Good morning, members, and good morning, Honourable Chair. So, the first one here relates to the refund of withholding tax under circumstances where the person who receives the withholding tax does not provide a certificate that indicates that they are either exempt from the withholding tax, for example, a pension fund, or they are subject to reduced withholding rates, perhaps because of an international tax treaty. And the situation then is that they need to get a refund because they were late, so the tax was withheld from them. And the way that works is that you would put the certificate in and you would claim the refund from the person who withheld the tax, in this case, a regulated intermediary. And the idea originally was that a regulated intermediary had a wide range of clients, so they would be able to refund this amount from other withholdings that they had collected fairly quickly. Unfortunately, the situation has come to light where there may be a particularly large shareholder and the other shareholders are relatively small, so that it becomes difficult to refund this tax within a reasonable period. And so what is being proposed here is that we switch to a model that we use when it's the company that does the withholding, which is if the refund cannot be made within a year, the regulated intermediary comes to SARS, asks for a refund of the balance, and then is able to refund the company concerned. So moving on to the next slide, we now come to the question of invoices in the customs and excise space. Now, an invoice is a very important document in the customs and excise space, and recently there has been a bit of debate as to just what kind of details are required in an invoice, particularly where we are dealing with goods where there are some challenges around valuation. Members may be aware of some of the difficulties that exist, for example, in the textile space. And so there's been some debate here as to what should be included and what not. And the idea here is to clarify this and then allow the commissioner to specifically prescribe the particulars that are required for certain classes of invoices so that we can get the required details we need to make a proper valuation of the goods that are being imported. Next slide. The next one is quite an important one and be very much welcomed by trade. So this proposes the introduction of a framework for providing advanced rulings in the customs space. This is something that we've had for a while now in the income tax space and the other taxes. And it is something that is provided for in the World Trade Organization's Trade Facilitation Agreement. Now, the benefits are clear. It assists clients, it gives them more certainty, and it's something that fits very much within SARS's strategic objectives of providing additional clarity. So that's something that South Africa has committed to implement in terms of its undertakings when it signed up to the Trade Facilitation Agreement. And this then provides for the framework for the implementation of such a system. Next slide. Um, members will be aware of the provisions that were introduced to require foreign electronic service providers to register in South Africa and pay over VAT on services provided into South Africa. Now, a practical issue that may arise here is that sometimes you have a very short spike or once off that pushes you over the 1 million rand registration threshold, and thereafter you don't do further business in the country. So this wouldn't apply to generally to the larger sort of mass market suppliers, but it may apply to sort of smaller niche suppliers. And there's already something similar to this in the domestic law, where what can happen is you would approach SARS, say, can I please not need to register here because this is a once-off, it's out of the ordinary, and then it just doesn't make sense for you to register, for SARS to take you on register for this once-off transaction that isn't going to be repeated, or this once-off event. So next slide, please. Now, members will also be aware that we have the concept of a registered tax practitioner, and a registered tax practitioner is registered both with SARS and with a recognized controlling body. Now, this is intended to ensure that the practitioner maintains professional standards. It gives an easy avenue of redress for taxpayers. If there are problems, they can go to the recognized controlling body. And there are two kinds of recognized controlling body. The first are the so-called statutory recognized controlling bodies. So those are bodies which exercise control over tax practitioners by way of a statute. And then there are the ones with, by application to the commissioner, they can be recognized provided they meet certain criteria. Now, there are two recognized controlling bodies by statute, and they are IRBA and the Legal Practice Council. Now, historically, IRBA used to exercise some control over tax practitioners. They took disciplinary action against auditors who engaged in problematic conduct with respect to tax issues. But more recently, they have focused more clearly on the audit aspect, and so there have been some legislative changes to recognize that greater focus. And so what now happens is IRBA would not look into the tax aspects. They would refer it to their equivalent of a recognized controlling body and a professional body accredited by IRBA. And so IRBA has requested us to remove them from the list of statutory recognized controlling bodies, which is now being proposed. The accredited body that IRBA has at present is the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. They're also a recognized controlling body for tax practitioners, so there should not be a practical impact with respect to this change, because the members would simply move from one recognized controlling body to another. So the next slide, please. All right. So if you wish to do business with government, and I believe certain larger corporations do this as well, they look for a positive or clear tax compliance status. And what SARS has encountered recently, and this particularly came to light in certain PPE transactions, was that in order to get a clean tax compliance status, a company would simply put in some null returns. So now they have met their requirement to have their returns up to date. Since there was no tax, they were null returns. They also have no tax debts outstanding. And so they tick the procedural boxes to be considered to be tax compliant. The fact of the matter is that you can see some very substantial transactions that these companies are undertaking. And so it's clear that there's a problem. And so what is being proposed here is that where you have something that is clearly problematic, and we're talking about fraud, misrepresentation, or non-disclosure of material facts, that SARS should be in a position to revoke access to your tax clearance status, so that it's not available to be checked. And that would then allow SARS the space to investigate this serious issue that has come to light. Now, we appreciate that that can be problematic for businesses, and there may be issues there that can be resolved. And so that's why there is a requirement that at least 10 business days notice to respond must be granted to the company or the taxpayer before the revocation takes place. That allows the taxpayer to come back to SARS and say, no, you misunderstand the situation. Here's what's really happening. And SARS can then say, okay, we understand there isn't in fact the serious problem that they thought there was. This is very similar to the approach that is used on initial application for a tax clearance status access. The problem, though, is that that's fine for when the application is initially made. The issue arises a little bit later in the process, and that's what this is, the gap that this particular proposal is meant to address. Next slide, please. The other issue that we're picking up is that you have newly formed companies that are spun up. No returns are required at this point. No payments are required at this point. So yes, technically, again, they are tax compliant, but at this stage, nobody knows whether they will or won't be tax compliant. So although we think we could probably do this under existing law, we think it would also be useful to have this properly documented. So the idea here is that SARS would add a statement to the tax compliance status, simply saying this is a newly registered taxpayer. It hasn't yet reached its first date for filing a return or making a payment. And that will allow the user to say, oh, okay, new company, although they have a positive tax clearance status, maybe I need to look at this a little bit more closely just to make sure we're comfortable from our perspective. From a SARS perspective, they clearly still have a positive tax clearance status, but it's just a little bit of a caveat so that the user knows where they stand when they rely on the tax clearance status. And then a sequel to a change that was made last year, members will recall that we ran into some abuse of the employment tax incentive, which was addressed last year where training contracts, and some of them of rather dubious value, were being dressed up as employment, and then employment tax incentive was being claimed and shared between the training service provider and the employer, with very little benefit for the actual employee or supposed employee. That brought into sharp focus that there is in fact no penalty in the Tax Administration Act for doing that. So that is being proposed this year, that we address that and that we permit a penalty to be imposed where reasonable care wasn't taken or it's simply an abusive set of transactions, just to ensure that there is a degree of consistency across the Act. And so that's it from my side. Thank you to the Honourable Members and to the Honourable Chair, and I'll now hand back to Young.
Okay, thank you. The last slide on the presentation refers to the proposal which was included in the 2022 budget review but not included in the 2022 draft TLAB. The reason why we want to put it to Parliament today, because we know that during public hearings, the taxpayers are going to come because they've already written a letter to us asking us why was the amendment not made. So this refers to clarifying the test treatment of collateral arrangements. In 2021, amendments were proposed in the draft TLAB regarding the abuse of the use of collateral. And the initial effective date on the draft TLAB was 1 January 2022. After receiving public comments, the effective date was changed to 1 January 2023. And then in the budget review, we said that during the 2022 legislative cycle, government will review the impact of the proposal and amendments could be made. So first is the review and then make amendments. So
immediately after the budget, we have had many meetings with the affected stakeholders regarding this proposal. And then after those meetings, because we were reviewing, government decided that no further amendments need to be made on the Taxation Laws Amendment Act. And the effective date of 1 January 2023 will continue, and the proposed amendments will continue as they stand. I'm putting this up front because we've already received letters, but I want to clarify that we said we're going to review before making amendments. It was never a done deal that amendments will be made. First, we had to make a review. Thank you, Honourable Members. That's all.
No, thank you. Thank you, Chair. As Yanga said, after this marathon, almost two-hour presentation, I'm sorry for torturing Honourable Members with such gory detail, but that's the nature of the tax system and the process. And thank you, Chair. So over to you, and we're happy to take questions.
Okay, thanks. We are struggling with connectivity. Even the parliamentary server is like it's down. We are using a Gmail here. There are problems there and there. Be that as it may, I'm reconnected. Honorable members, there we are with the presentations. So the commissioner didn't manage to connect here.
No. He's not on, Chair.
Okay. Honorable members, there we are with the presentations. Clarity, seeking questions, comments. Dr. George, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation. I know that there's going to be still lots of inputs on this, so I'll just be brief. I want to raise the question on retirement reform, which I think was mentioned that this is obviously one of the big items coming through that's been on the table for a very long time. It seems to me that it's actually a three-pot system, not a two-pot system if you look at a vested pot. But anyway, that's just a comment I want to make on that. But more specifically, it makes provision for the withdrawal of a portion of the savings pot. So that's very clear. And what happens when you withdraw money from a pension fund, as we all know, is that you pay tax on that money. And it is removed out of the fund. And you cannot enjoy any growth on it in the future because it's actually been withdrawn. Now, what I want to know, and this has been raised by me previously, that why there cannot be provision for a loan facility on a fund. Now, I have raised it before through a private member's bill, but that bill was fundamentally misunderstood because it was basically understood somehow that it would be a withdrawal from the fund, but it was not. So the point is this. We are looking at a proposal to withdraw from the fund and pay tax on withdrawal, and the money's gone forever out of that pot, right? It will be spent in the economy. Now, I cannot see why there cannot be a provision for a loan facility on the fund that then permits the member to utilize a portion of the fund as a surety for a loan. It's not a withdrawal, a surety for a loan. The loan is then given to the member, obviously determined according to affordability, the National Credit Act, the rules of the fund, etc. And then the member can pay that back, which means then that they do not need to take a withdrawal from the fund. The money remains in the fund. It remains invested, and then they get the benefit of that investment, and they have not taken it out of the fund or paid tax on it. Then the member pays back the loan, possibly on soft terms, because it is 100% backed by surety in the fund. Now, I don't think that's a difficult concept to understand. So there is no reason why that facility could not be there. It would not mean that everybody would default. It would not mean that it would put everybody into unaffordable debt because the National Credit Act would still apply. But what it would mean is that members would be able to utilize their own asset as a surety for a loan that they then pay back. Yes, some people would default. That is probably so, but not everybody would. So I cannot see why a facility like that cannot be included in the reform package that is now on the table. Other than that, I want to say it is good to see that there is progress on this matter. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Dr. George. Any other member who would like to make a contribution or ask a question? Honorable Abraham, over to you.
No, thank you, Chair. Thank you so much. It's always empowering to listen on an annual basis to Yanga and her team. But I just want to say that I'm also carrying a gadget similar to Yanga's, but doesn't show the video. Yanga. I want to talk to the issue of the 5% that can be accessed by companies by way of tax relief. And I just wanted to check whether I hear it is with the Department of Environmental Affairs. But I would like to check whether Treasury knows that the companies are accessing the 5% and at what rate, because my question really, Chair, is around whether companies are aware that this is an advantage that they could access if they comply first and foremost and really meet that relief. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Noxie. Is it possible now that we have a gadget without a camera when we have got an iPhone 13? Noxie? Are there more questions?
Not yet. I don't have the iPhone
13 yet. Even my mother has got a phone with a camera, though she doesn't use it. But a phone has a camera.
It's a protest. I'm protesting against Yanga's stance. I don't believe that Yanga cannot show her video. I don't believe that. I'm just protesting, Jay.
Yeah, my mother is 8 this year. We have bought a camera, phone with a camera, but the grandchildren use it. So I don't believe that there's any gadget without a camera. So that the camera has to be fixed, Yanga. It's a rule of parliament that when we present, we must be visible because they are audio streaming the meeting. Let me go back to Treasury and SARS. Can you please respond to those inputs or questions from the two members?
Yes, no, thank you, Chair, and honorable members. And honorable Abrams will investigate Yanga because, yeah, for 2 years she says her laptop doesn't allow or gadgets don't allow her to put on a camera. And either she's deliberately sticking to old technology or so, but I think she doesn't want to be visible. But we'll see how we can help her. Now, Honorable Chair, I think Honorable George is correct. He did bring in the private members bill. Try to signal the problems at the time, what happens when it's defaults. And of course, this is allowed under current legislation. It's just that each fund must determine whether it's going to allow it. And generally in our discussions, I think it's really, I mean, like any tool, it may have its positives. We're not saying there's no positives, but on the whole, it really, there's a lot of certainly anecdotal evidence when we've talked to the different funds of abuse and so on. And you will see that under the Regulation 28, we've even reduced the percentage going forward. And it's something that I think we even have to review whether we want that mechanism to stay to the extent that it's allowed. We do feel that this mechanism to withdraw from the one-third pot on the whole is a better option. It's understandable. Yes, people do withdraw, but at least they do preserve the two-thirds. And on the whole, I think, no one knows exactly, but we hope that that will lead to more preservation and not less. And yes, we use the tax, the withdrawal taxes, almost as a disincentive. And I did say that, you know, in when you look at pensions, it's one of the classic examples around behavioral theory. Is how to prompt people, how to nudge people, not force people, nudge people. Yes, some things you force when you say we have mandatory contributory system, that's what we want to go to. But it is more about nudging and providing incentives. And, you know, for all those reasons, I think we certainly did not support the approach of expanding on the current loans for retirement funds. Now, again, I mean, I'm not saying that anybody is 100% right or wrong in this. It is a judgment call, but we feel this system is a better option. And even this system will have its pros and its cons. And, you know, we can debate it and see how it evolves and what the incentives and disincentives are. But the bottom line is you almost have to push everyone to really save, most people to save for their retirement. Otherwise, they simply won't. And you want to make sure that you preserve something. And the judgment call we've made is that through this system, at least we should achieve higher rates of preservation. And also, as part of it, if we take the steps to reform and get more mandatory contribution or auto-enrollment, that will also get many more people into the net. But again, we can have, you know, no one way is perfect and the only way either. There are other mechanisms. And I would, you know, continue to invite Honorable George, if you would like, we'd be happy to have a technical discussion through this forum or invite you to the Treasury to discuss the pros and cons. Because I'm trying to understand. I know you feel strongly about it, but I must say I haven't got to understand why he feels so strongly. And perhaps he's got arguments that haven't been put up more explicitly. And as I said, there's no one way of doing things, but we're happy to engage on that. Notwithstanding that, I think that clearly, even if we had a loan system, I think that we would need this withdrawal pot. And can I say that it does look like there are some countries also expanding on this two-pot system. Honorable George is right that there is a third pot with all the vested amounts, which you hope, in some way we can even incentivize people to move towards the two pots, but we're obviously not forcing people. We're accepting their rights and then preserving their rights. So that's as far as the loans is concerned. I don't know if Alvina or Basil, you want to come in and add, or Chris or Nombula or Malay. Does anyone want to add from the treasury side? Okay, so let me move on. I think on the 5%, that relates to the carbon tax. I'll ask Chris or Sharlin to come in. It does have to be coordinated with the Department of Environmental Affairs Policy going forward. And yes, we are aware of it. There's only 100 companies. Just your scope one companies currently to which the carbon tax applies. I'm not sure we are aware of it directly, but let Sharlin come in, or Chris.
Thanks, Momo. So currently there's around 370 licensed entities for purposes of the carbon tax with SARS, and about 85% of them are tax compliant. So overall, when you look at the revenues from the carbon tax since its introduction, we've collected just over 2 billion rands. So that indicates that a large proportion of the tax-free allowances have been claimed under the carbon tax, including the carbon budget allowance. So I think we can say that companies are aware of the carbon budget allowance. There's extensive engagements through the Department of Environment on the carbon budgeting system, and there's a process between the Department of Environment and SARS to ensure that companies get the required documentation in order to claim the 5% allowance. Thanks.
Thanks, Sharlin, and thanks for correcting me. There's more like 400 companies. But because they're so few, and they tend to be the bigger ones, because they really are the big emitters, they tend to know the tax system as it applies to them quite well. And let me say, Chair, I mean, I was also noticing overnight there was an article from one of the really big emitters in South Africa sort of saying that, there's no certainty on a particular of these allowances. Generally, climate change does bring great uncertainty to everybody, to the whole world. So you must just have that perspective. And to the extent that we take steps as a world, not just as South Africa, to bring down greenhouse gas emissions and try and achieve the maximum 1.5 degrees Celsius, or to limit it to that degree. To the extent that we don't succeed, and everything suggests that it's going to get tougher and tougher as countries start too late to take steps, that the measures that we're going to have to take as a world will actually get to be much stronger. So the one thing you can be certain is if we don't succeed now globally, that it's going to mean that we're going to take steps to mitigate and adapt against climate change. To the extent that we can, from a policy side, we hardly say on any text that for the next 20 years, this is the path. So here we've got a whole path over a number of years of how the carbon tax will be going up. Just to, and obviously, if companies delay in doing something now, the carbon tax is going to be much higher going forward. So we're almost saying you can be certain it's going to go up. To the extent that all the allowances are clear, yes, there might be some uncertainty, but compared to the uncertainty of climate change, I think it pales into, well, it's not really that significant. And some things it's possible to give a lot of clarity, and we do with the carbon tax, but we continually engage with companies, especially as they are talking about green investments, to engage with them and to see how we can facilitate greener investments. So that's just a broad perspective we have. These companies are all very aware of the carbon tax. Most, of course, not surprisingly, oppose the carbon tax because they were emitting it's going to be more expensive. And yes, it does have an impact on the rest of society both ways. And it's something that we're just going to have to look at. And it's a dynamic situation. So I'll stop there, Chair, just with regard to the carbon tax and climate change.
Do we have members? Let me check here, Momo and your team. During the time of COVID, when more than 2 million people lost jobs or they were in financial distress, there was a talk about members of various schemes to have access to their pension savings that they can withdraw. Yet, Honorable George is talking about a loan. There was also a talk about a withdrawal of a certain portion of the money which is invested in the pension fund. Is it catered for here? Yeah. Because I can see that you have issued a statement about what you call a retirement reform and the draft legislation for the two-pot system. What we have been discussing from 2020 in regard to members having a direct access to their pension and withdraw a particular portion, is this retirement reform catering for that? I can't remember whether you call it Regulation 28 or, but there was a specific regulation that we talked about. And the minister, I think either in his budget speech or MTBBPS, also mentioned this issue because there was lots of pressure from many, many South Africans who were in serious financial distress. Is it catered for, or here we're talking about something else? Thanks.
So, Chair, yes, this is the measure that emerges from the discussions in 2020 when the unions first made this request to us. And yes, it is, Chair, a very, very complex situation because if you, firstly, you had to change the law to allow for such withdrawals. Bear in mind that those who resigned could access it and did access it in many instances, I would imagine. It's just those that, and one of the objectives is we don't want people to resign from their jobs to have access to a small amount of their retirement fund. So this is a direct response for that. It has taken a long time because the issues are really complex. The amount of work and engagements we've had and the concerns we've had to deal with, I think, has resulted in the current product. And in a sense, it's not going to help people now. It's going to help people if there's a similar future crisis, I would add. And to the extent that it does, even after it gets enacted, I think that we are going to get from funds concerns they have about how quickly they can implement because their funds are already invested. So we are concerned about possible liquidity problems or runs. We look at countries like Chile, what happened. So Chair, yes, it does try and address that the concerns or raise when COVID started on access to pension funds or their pension savings by members. But it has taken longer, and we've had to put a lot of restraints, because otherwise, you know, people will cash in everything and you will have liquidity problems and it can cause problems. So we've had to take all of those into account. And we think that we've got a model now that can work, and we'll tweak it as we go. And in fact, we are really looking forward to the comments and see how all the various stakeholders see this proposal. And I have no doubt we'll have to make some amendments even now, once we have after we've had the hearings. But it does try and address the 2020 problem raised when COVID started.
No, okay. We'll continue to engage before we pass the legislation to make sure that all those issues that were raised are clearly catered for. Any other member who would like to make an input or ask a question? I don't see any member raising a hand in the platform. So let's move to the next item. Before we close, Tebogo Buhle, are there announcements?
We have no announcements except that we're having another meeting tomorrow.
Okay. No,
I'll be sending the link and all other documentation after this meeting has ended.
Okay. And please talk to IT to get the parliamentary website to be up and running. Okay. Thanks very much, honorable members. Treasury, led by the acting DG, Comrade Momo, SARS, other officials from the National Treasury, the World Parliamentary Team, support team present here, other stakeholders who are here in the platform. I've seen others who have, like Saika, who have just logged in, the media, and the public in general. Thanks very much for participating in this meeting. We'll meet again tomorrow. The meeting is adjourned. Thanks.
Thank you very much.